Good evening. Tonight I will be reading the second part of A Country Christmas by Louisa May Alcott. So far, Sophie Vaughn is spending Christmas in Vermont with her Aunt Plummy and cousins Saul and Ruth. She's invited her city friends Emily and Randall to stay with them to get a taste of simple country living. They found it difficult to keep their word when they were called at 6:30 next morning. Their rooms were warm, however, and they managed to scramble down in time for breakfast, guided by the fragrance of coffee and Aunt Plummy's shrill voice singing the good old hymn, "Lord, in the morning thou shalt hear my voice ascending high." An open fire blazed on the hearth, for the cooking was done in the lean-to, and the spacious, sunny kitchen was kept in all its old-fashioned perfection, with the wooden settle in a warm nook, the tall clock behind the door, copper and pewter utensils shining on the dresser, old china in the corner closet, and a little spinning wheel rescued from the garret by Sophie to adorn the deep window, full of scarlet geraniums, Christmas roses, and white chrysanthemums. The young lady, in a checked apron and mob cap, greeted her friends with a dish of buckwheats in one hand and a pair of cheeks that proved she'd been learning to fry those delectable cakes. "You do keep it up in earnest, upon my word, and very becoming it is, dear. But won't you ruin your complexion and roughen your hands if you do so much of this new fancy work?" asked Emily, much amazed at this novel freak. "I like it, and really believe I've found my proper sphere at last. Domestic life seems so pleasant to me that I feel as if I'd better keep it up for the rest of my life," answered Sophie, making a pretty picture of herself as she cut great slices of brown bread, with the early sunshine touching her happy face. "The charming Miss Vaughn in the role of a farmer's wife. I find it difficult to imagine and shrink from the thought of the widespread dismay such a fate will produce among her adorers," added Randall, as he basked in the glow of the hospitable fire. "She might do worse, but come to breakfast and do honor to my handiwork," said Sophie, thinking of her worn-out millionaire, and rather nettled by the satiric smile on Randall's lips. "What an appetite early rising gives one! I feel equal to almost anything, so let me help wash cups," said Emily, with unusual energy, when the hearty meal was over and Sophie began to pick up the dishes as if it was her usual work. Ruth went to the window to water the flowers, and Randall followed to make himself agreeable, remembering her defense of him last night. He was used to admiration from feminine eyes and flattery from soft lips, but found something new and charming in the innocent delight which showed itself at his approach in blushes more eloquent than words and shy glances from eyes full of hero worship. "I hope you're going to spare me a posy for tomorrow night, since I can be fine in no other way to do honor to the dance Miss Sophie proposes for us," he said, leaning in the bay window to look down on the little girl with the devoted air he usually wore for pretty women. "Anything you'd like. I should be so glad to have you wear my flowers. There'll be enough for all, and I've nothing else to give to people who've made me as happy as Cousin Sophie and you," answered Ruth, half drowning her great calla as she spoke with grateful warmth. "You must make her happy by accepting the invitation to go home with her, which I heard her given last night. A peep at the world would do you good, and be a pleasant change, I think." "Oh, very pleasant. But would it do me good?" said Ruth. She looked up with sudden seriousness in her blue eyes, as a child questions an elder, eager yet wistful. "Why not?" asked Randall, wondering at the hesitation. "I might grow discontented with things here if I saw splendid houses and fine people. I'm very happy now, and it would break my heart to lose that happiness, or ever learn to be ashamed of home." "But don't you long for more pleasure, new scenes, and other friends than these?" asked the man, touched by the little creature's loyalty to the things she knew and loved. "Very often, but Mother says when I'm ready they will come, so I wait and try not to be impatient." But Ruth's eyes looked out over the green leaves as if the longing was very strong within her to see more of the unknown world lying beyond the mountains that hemmed her in. "It is natural for birds to hop out of the nest, so I shall expect to see you over there before long and ask you how you enjoy your first flight," said Randall, in a paternal tone that had a curious effect on Ruth. To his surprise, she laughed, then blushed like one of her own roses, and answered with a demure dignity that was very pretty to see, "I intend to hop soon, but it won't be a very long flight, or very far from Mother. She can't spare me, and nobody in the world can fill her place to me." "Bless the child, does she think I'm going to make love to her?" thought Randall, much amused, but quite mistaken. Wiser women had thought so when he assumed the caressing air with which he beguiled them into the little revelations of character he liked to use, as the south wind makes flowers open their hearts to give up their odor, then leaves them to carry it elsewhere, the more welcome for the stolen sweetness. "Perhaps you're right. The maternal wing is a safe shelter for confiding little souls like you, Miss Ruth. "You will be as comfortable here as your flowers in this sunny window," he said, carelessly pinching geranium leaves and ruffling the roses till the pink petals of the largest fluttered to the floor. As if she instinctively felt and resented something in the man which his act symbolized, the girl answered quietly, as she went on with her work, "Yes, if the frost does not touch me, or careless people spoil me too soon." Before Randall could reply, Aunt Plummy approached like a maternal hen who sees her chicken in danger. "Saul's going to Haw Wood after he's done with his chores. Maybe you'd like to go along? The view's good. Road's well broke, and the day uncommon fine." "Thanks, it will be delightful, I dare say," politely responded the lion, with a secret shudder at the idea of a rural promenade at 8 a.m. in the winter. "Come on, then. We'll feed the stock, and then I'll show you how to yoke oxen," said Saul, with a twinkle in his eye as he led the way, when his new aide had muffled himself up as if for a polar voyage. "Now that's too bad of Saul. He did it on purpose just to please you, Sophie," cried Ruth presently, and the girls ran to the window to behold Randall bravely following his host with a pail of pig's food in each hand, and an expression of resigned disgust upon his aristocratic face. "To what base uses may we come?" quoted Emily, as they all nodded and smiled upon the victim as he looked back from the barnyard, where he was clamorously welcomed by his new charges. "It is rather a shock at first, but it will do him good, and Saul won't be too hard upon him, I'm sure," said Sophie, going back to her work, while Ruth turned her best buds to the sun that they might be ready for a peace offering tomorrow. There was a merry clatter in the big kitchen for an hour. Then Aunt Plummy and her daughter shut themselves up in the pantry to perform some culinary rites, and the young ladies went to inspect certain antique costumes laid forth in Sophie's room. "You see, Em, I thought it would be appropriate to the house in season to have an old-fashioned dance. Aunt has quantities of ancient finery stowed away, for great-grandfather Bassett was a fine old gentleman, and his family lived in state. Take your choice of the crimson, blue, or silver-gray damask. Ruth is to wear the worked muslin and quilted white satin skirt with that coquettish hat. Being dark, I'll take the red and trim it up with this fine lace. You must wear the blue and primrose damask, with the distracting high-heeled shoes. Have you any suits for the men?" asked Emily, throwing herself at once into the all-absorbing matter of costume. "A claret velvet coat and vest, silk stockings, cocked hat, and snuff-box for Randall. Nothing large enough for Saul, so he must wear his uniform. Won't Aunt Plummy be superb in this plum-colored satin and immense cap?" A delightful morning was spent in adapting the faded finery of the past to the blooming beauty of the present, and time and tons flew till the toot of a horn called them down to dinner. The girls were amazed to see Randall come whistling up the road with his trousers tucked into his boots, blue mittens on his hands, and an unusual amount of energy in his whole figure as he drove the oxen, while Saul laughed at his vain attempts to guide the bewildered beasts. "It's immense! The view from the hill's well worth seeing, for the snow glorifies the landscape and reminds one of Switzerland. I'm going to make a sketch of it this afternoon. Better come and enjoy the delicious freshness, young ladies." Randall was eating with such an appetite that he did not see the glances the girls exchanged as they promised to go. "Bring home some more wintergreen. I want things to be real nice, and we haven't enough for the kitchen," said Ruth, dimpling with girlish delight as she imagined herself dancing under the green garlands in her grandmother's wedding gown. It was very lovely on the hill, for far as the eye could reach lay the wintry landscape sparkling with the brief beauty of sunshine on virgin snow. Pines sighed overhead, hardy birds flitted to and fro, and in all the trodden spots rose the little spires of evergreen ready for its Christmas duty. Deeper in the woods sounded the measured ring of axes, the crash of falling trees, while the red shirts of the men added color to the scene, and a fresh wind brought the aromatic breath of newly cloven hemlock and pine. "How beautiful it is! I never knew before what winter woods were like. Did you, Sophie?" asked Emily, sitting on a stump to enjoy the novel pleasure at her ease. "I found out lately. Saul lets me come as often as I like, and this fine air seems to make a new creature of me," answered Sophie, looking about her with sparkling eyes, as if this was a kingdom where she reigned supreme. "Something's making a new creature of you, that's very evident. I haven't yet discovered whether it is the air, or some magic herb among that green stuff you are gathering so diligently," and Emily laughed to see the color deepen beautifully in her friend's half-averted face. "Scarlet is the only wear just now, I find. If we are lost like babes in the woods, there are plenty of red rust to cover us with leaves," and Randall joined Emily's laugh, with a glance at Saul, who had just pulled his coat off. "You wanted to see this tree go down, so stand from under and I'll show you how it's done," said the farmer, taking up his axe. not unwilling to gratify his guests and display his manly accomplishments at the same time. It was a fine sight, the stalwart man swinging his axe with magnificent strength and skill, each blow sending a thrill through the stately tree, till its heart was reached and it tottered to its fall. Never pausing for breath, Saul shook his yellow mane out of his eyes and hewed away, while the drops stood on his forehead and his arm ached, as bent on distinguishing himself as he had been a knight tilting against his rival for his lady's favor. I don't know which to admire most, the man or his muscle. One doesn't often see such vigor, size, and comeliness in these degenerate days, said Randall, mentally booking the fine figure in the red shirt. I think we've discovered a rough diamond. I only wonder if Sophie is going to try and polish it, answered Emily, glancing at her friend, who stood a little apart, watching the rise and fall of the axe as intently as if her fate depended upon it. Down rushed the tree at last, and leaving them to examine a crow's nest in its branches, Saul went off to his men, as he found the praise of his prowess rather too much for him. Randall fell to sketching, the girls to their garland-making, and for a little while the sunny woodland nook was full of lively chat and pleasant laughter, for the air exhilarated them all like wine. Suddenly a man came running from the wood, pale and anxious, saying as he hastened by for help, "Blasted tree fell on him! Bleed to death before the doctor comes!" "Who? Who?" cried the startled trio. But the man ran on with some breathless reply, in which only a name was audible. "Bassett." "The deuce it is," said Randall, and he dropped his pencil, while the girls sprang up in dismay. Then, with one impulse, they hastened to the distant group, half visible behind the fallen trees and corded wood. Sophie was there first, and forcing her way through the little crowd of men, saw a red-shirted figure on the ground, crushed and bleeding, and threw herself down beside it with a cry that pierced the hearts of those who heard it. In the act, she saw it was not Saul, and covered her bewildered face as if to hide its joy. A strong arm lifted her, and the familiar voice said cheeringly, "I'm all right, dear. Poor Bruce is hurt, but we've sent for help. Better go right home and forget all about it." "Yes, I will, if I can do nothing." And Sophie meekly returned to her friends, who stood outside the circle over which Saul's head towered, assuring them of his safety. Hoping they had not seen her agitation, she led Emily away, leaving Randall to give what aid he could and bring them news of the poor woodchopper's state. Aunt Plummy produced the camphor the moment she saw Sophie's pale face and made her lie down, while the brave old lady trudged briskly off with bandages and brandy to the scene of action. On her return, she brought comfortable news of the man, so the little flurry blew over and was forgotten by all but Sophie, who remained pale and quiet all the evening, tying evergreen as if her life depended on it. "A good night's sleep will set her up. She ain't used to such things, dear child, and needs cosseting," said Aunt Plummy, purring over her until she was in her bed, with a hot stone at her feet and a bowl of herb tea to quiet her nerves. An hour later, when Emily went up, she peeped in to see if Sophie was sleeping nicely, and was surprised to find the invalid wrapped in a dressing gown, writing busily. "Last will and testament, or sudden inspiration, dear? How are you? Faint or feverish, delirious, or in the dumps? Saul looks so anxious, and Mrs. Bassett hushes us all up so, I came to bed, leaving Randall to entertain Ruth." As she spoke, Emily saw the papers disappear in a portfolio, and Sophie rose with a yawn. "I was writing letters, but I'm sleepy now. Quite over my foolish fright, thank you. Go and get your beauty sleep that you may dazzle the natives tomorrow." "So glad. Good night." And Emily went away, saying to herself, "Something's going on, and I must find out what it is before I leave. Sophie can't blind me." But Sophie did all the next day, being delightfully gay at the dinner, and devoting herself to the young minister who was invited to meet the distinguished novelist, and evidently being afraid of him, gladly basked in the smiles of his charming neighbor. A dashing sleigh ride occupied the afternoon, and then great was the fun and excitement over the costumes. Aunt Plummy laughed till the tears rolled down her cheeks as the girls compressed her into the plum-colored gown with its short waist, leg-of-mutton sleeves, and narrow skirt. But a worked scarf hid all deficiencies, and the towering cap struck awe into the soul of the most frivolous observer. "Keep an eye on me, girls, for I shall certainly split somewheres or lose my headpiece off when I'm trotting round. What would my blessed mother say if she could see me rigged out in her best things?" And with a smile and a sigh, the old lady departed to look after the boys and see that supper was all right. Three prettier damsels never tripped down the wide staircase than the brilliant brunette in crimson brocade, the pensive blonde in blue, or the rosy little bride in old muslin and white satin. A gallant court gentleman met them in the hall with a superb bow and escorted them to the parlor, where Grandma Bassett's ghost was discovered dancing with a modern major in full uniform. Mutual admiration and many compliments followed, till other ancient ladies and gentlemen all arrived in manners of queer costumes, and the old house seemed to wake from its humdrum quietude to sudden music and merriment, as if a past generation had returned to keep its Christmas there. The village fiddler soon struck up the good old tunes, and then the strangers saw dancing that filled them with mingled mirth and envy. It was so droll, yet so hearty. The young men, unusually awkward in their grandfather's knee breeches, flapping vests and swallowtail coats, footed it bravely with the buxom girls who were the prettier for their quaintness, and danced with such vigor that their high combs stood awry, their furbelows waved wildly, and their cheeks were as red as their breast knots or hose. It was impossible to stand still, and one after the other the city folk yielded to the spell, Randall leading off with Ruth, Sophie swept away by Saul, and Emily being taken possession of by a young giant of 18, who spun her around with a boyish impetuosity that took her breath away. Even Aunt Plummy was discovered jigging it alone in the pantry, as if the music was too much for her, and the plates and glasses jingled gaily on the shelves in time to Money Musk and Fisher's Hornpipe. A pause came at last, however, and fans fluttered, heated brows were wiped, jokes were made, lovers exchanged confidences, and every nook and corner held a man and maid carrying on the sweet game which is never out of fashion. There was a glitter of gold lace in the back entry, and a train of blue and primrose shone in the dim light. There was a richer crimson than that of the geraniums in the deep window, and a dainty shoe tapped the bare floor impatiently as the brilliant black eyes looked everywhere for the court gentlemen, while their owner listened to the gruff prattle of an enamored boy. But in the upper hall walked a little white ghost, as if waiting for some shadowy companion, and when a dark form appeared, ran to take its arm, saying in a tone of soft satisfaction, "I was so afraid you wouldn't come." "Why did you leave me, Ruth?" answered a manly voice in a tone of surprise, though the small hand slipping from the velvet coat sleeve was replaced, as if it was pleasant to feel it there. A pause, and then the other voice answered demurely, "Because I was afraid my head would be turned by the fine things you were saying." "It is impossible to help saying what one feels to such an artless little creature as you are. It does me good to admire anything so fresh and sweet, and won't harm you." "It might if—" "If what, my Daisy?" "I believed it," and a laugh seemed to finish the broken sentence better than the words. "You may, Ruth, for I do sincerely admire the most genuine girl I've seen for a long time, and walking here with you in your bridal white, I was just asking myself if I should not be a happier man with a home of my own and a little wife hanging on my arm than drifting about the world as I do now with only myself to care for." "I know you would," and Ruth spoke so earnestly that Randall was both touched and startled, fearing he had ventured too far in a mood of unwonted sentiment, born of the romance of the hour and the sweet frankness of his companion. "Then you don't think it would be rash for some sweet woman to take me in hand and make me happy, since fame is a failure?" "Oh, no, it would be easy work if she loved you. I know someone, if only I dared to tell her name." "Upon my soul, this is cool," and Randall looked down, wondering if the audacious lady on his arm could be shy Ruth. If he had seen the malicious merriment in her eyes, he would have been more humiliated still. But they were modestly averted, and the face under the little hat was full of soft agitation, rather dangerous even to a man of the world. "She's a captivating little creature, but it's too soon for anything but a mild flirtation. I must delay further innocent revelations, or I shall do something rash." While making this excellent resolution, Randall had been pressing the hand upon his arm and gently pacing down the dimly lighted hall with the sound of music in his ears, Ruth's sweetest roses in his buttonhole, and a loving little girl beside him, as he thought. "You shall tell me by and by when we are in town. I'm sure you'll come, and meanwhile don't forget me." "I am going in the spring, but I shall not be with Sophie," answered Ruth in a whisper. "With whom, then?" "I shall long to see you." "With my husband. I am to be married in May." "The deuce you are!" escaped Randall, as he stopped short to stare at his companion, sure she was not in earnest. But she was, for as he looked, the sound of steps coming up the back stairs made her whole face flush and brighten with the unmistakable glow of happy love, and she completed Randall's astonishment by running into the arms of the young minister, saying with an irrepressible laugh, "Oh, John, why didn't you come before?" The court gentleman was all right in a moment, and the coolest of the three as he offered his congratulations and gracefully retired, leaving the lovers to enjoy the tryst he had delayed. But as he went downstairs, his brows were knit, and he slapped the broad railing smartly with his cocked hat, as if some irritation must find vent in a more energetic way than merely saying, "Confound the little baggage," under his breath. Such an amazing supper came from Aunt Plummy's big pantry that the city guests could not eat for laughing at the queer dishes circulating through the rooms and copiously partaken of by the hearty young folks. Donuts and cheese, pie and pickles, cider and tea, baked beans and custards, cake and cold turkey, bread and butter, plum pudding, and French bonbons, Sophie's contribution. "May I offer you the native delicacies and share your plate? Both are very good, but the chinas run short, and after such vigorous exercise as you've had, you must need refreshment." "I'm sure I do," said Randall, bowing before Emily with a great blue platter laden with 2 doughnuts, 2 wedges of pumpkin pie, and 2 spoons. The smile with which she welcomed him, the alacrity with which she made room beside her, and seemed to enjoy the supper he brought, was so soothing to his ruffled spirit that he soon began to feel that there is no friend like an old friend, that it would not be difficult to name a sweet woman who would take him in hand and would make him happy if he cared to ask her. And he began to think that he would, by and by. It was so pleasant to sit in that green corner, with waves of crimson brocade flowing over his feet, and a fine face softening beautifully under his eyes. The supper was not romantic, but the situation was, and Emily found the pie ambrosial food eaten with the man she loved, whose eyes talked more eloquently than the tongue just then busy with a doughnut. Ruth kept away, but glanced at them as she served her company, and her own happy experience helped her to see that all was going well in that quarter. Saul and Sophie emerged from the back entry with shining countenances, but carefully avoided each other for the rest of the evening. No one observed this but Aunt Plummy from the recesses of her pantry, and she folded her hands as if well content as she murmured fervently over a pan of crullers, "Bless the dears, now I can die happy." Everyone thought Sophie's old-fashioned dress immensely becoming, and several of his former men said to Saul with blunt admiration, "Major, you look tonight as you used to after we'd gained a big battle." "I feel as if I had," answered the splendid major, with eyes much brighter than his buttons, and a heart under them infinitely prouder than when he was promoted on the field of honor, for his Waterloo was won. There was more dancing, followed by games, in which Aunt Plummy shone preeminent, for the supper was off her mind and she could enjoy herself. There were shouts of merriment as the blithe old lady twirled the platter, hunted the squirrel, and went to Jerusalem like a girl of 16, her cap in a ruinous condition, and every seam of the purple dress straining like sails in a gale. It was great fun, but at midnight it came to an end, and the young folks, still bubbling over with innocent jollity, went jingling away along the snowy hills, unanimously pronouncing Mrs. Bassett's party the best of the season. "Never had such a good time in my life," exclaimed Sophie, as the family stood together in the kitchen where the candles among the wreaths were going out, and the floor was strewn with wrecks of past joy. "I'm proper glad, dear. Now you all go to bed and lay as late as you like tomorrow. I'm so kind of worked up I couldn't sleep, so Sol and me will put things to rights without a mite of noise to disturb you." And Aunt Plummy sent them off with a smile that was a benediction, Sophie thought. The dear old soul speaks as if midnight was an unheard-of hour for Christmas to be up. What would she say if she knew how we seldom go to bed till dawn in the ball season? I'm so wide awake I've half a mind to pack a little. Randall must go at 2, he says, and we shall want his escort, said Emily, as the girls laid away their brocades and the press in Sophie's room. I'm not going. Aunt can't spare me, and there's nothing to go for yet, answered Sophie, beginning to take the white chrysanthemums out of her pretty hair. My dear child, you'll die of ennui up here. Very nice for a week or so, but frightful for a winter. We're going to be very gay and cannot get on without you, cried Emily, dismayed at the suggestion. You'll have to, for I'm not coming. I'm very happy here, and so tired of the frivolous life I lead in town, that I've decided to try a better one. And Sophie's face mirrored in the reflection of a sweetest content. Have you lost your mind? Experienced religion? Or any other dreadful thing? You always were odd, but this last freak is the strangest of all. What will your guardian say, and the world? Added Emily, in the awe-stricken tone of one who stood in fear of the omnipotent Mrs. Gundry. Guardy will be glad to be rid of me, and I don't care for that world, cried Sophie, snapping her fingers with a joyful sort of recklessness which completed Emily's bewilderment. But, Mr. Hammond, are you going to throw away millions? Lose your chance of making the best match in the city and driving the girls of our set out of their wits with envy? Sophie laughed at her friend's despairing cry, and turning round said quietly, I wrote to Mr. Hammond last night, and this evening received my reward for being an honest girl. Saul and I are to be married in the spring when Ruth is. Emily fell prone upon the bed as if the announcement was too much for her, but was up again in an instant to declare with prophetic solemnity, I knew something was going on, but hope to get you away before you were lost. Sophie, you will repent. Be warned and forget this sad delusion. Too late for that. The pain I suffered yesterday when I thought Saul was dead showed me how well I loved him. Tonight he asked me to stay, and no power in the world can part us. Oh, Emily, it's all so sweet, so beautiful, that everything is possible, and I know I shall be happy in this dear old home, full of love and peace and honest hearts. I only hope you may find as true and tender a man to live for as my Saul. Sophie's face was more eloquent than her fervent words, and Emily beautifully illustrated the inconsistency of her sex by suddenly embracing her friend with the incoherent exclamation, I think I have, dear. Your brave Saul is worth a dozen old Hammonds, and I do believe you're right. It's unnecessary to tell how, as if drawn by the irresistible magic of sympathy, Ruth and her mother crept in one by one to join the midnight conference and add their smiles and tears, tender hopes and proud delight to the joys of that memorable hour, nor how Saul, unable to sleep, mounted guard below, and meeting Randall prowling down to soothe his nerves with a surreptitious cigar, found it impossible to help confiding to his attentive ear the happiness that would break bounds and overflow in unusual eloquence. Peace fell upon the old house at last, and all slept as if some magic herb had touched their eyelids, bringing blissful dreams and a glad awakening. "Can't we persuade you to come with us, Miss Sophie?" asked Randall the next day as they made their adieu. "I'm under orders now, and dare not disobey my superior officer," answered Sophie, handing her major his driving gloves, with a look which plainly showed that she had joined the great army of devoted women who enlist for life and ask no pay but love. "I shall depend upon being invited to your wedding, then, and yours too, Miss Ruth," added Randall, shaking hands with the little baggage, as if he had quite forgiven her mockery and forgotten his own brief lapse into sentiment. Before she could reply, Aunt Plumy said, in a tone of calm conviction that made them all laugh, and some of them look conscious, "Spring is a good time for weddings, and I shouldn't wonder if there was quite a number." "Nor I," said Saul and Sophie, as they smiled at one another, as they saw how carefully Randall arranged Emily's wraps. Then, with kisses, thanks, and all the good wishes that happy hearts could imagine, the guests drove away to remember long and gratefully that pleasant country Christmas. Good evening, and thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful Christmas and happy holidays.